Interview with Frank Chin, December 8th, 2010, in New York City by Kenneth Durr. I think this is my first opportunity to talk to somebody who studied civil engineering.
Oh, good for you. It's important. It's good for you.
Folks who study civil engineering don't usually end up in the securities business. Tell me a little bit about that interest and how you got from that into what you're doing now.
Let's see, where do we start?
MIT?
Well, you know, I went to civil engineering undergraduate. Then when I got out, which was the Cooper Union in New York, then after I got out of undergraduate, I went to MIT graduate school in civil engineering, majored in planning, transportation systems planning. Actually, I got an interest in aviation, but basically after I got out of MIT, I basically wound up getting a job with the city of New York, worked in the Transportation Administration, which is the city's Department of Transportation. Worked on planning studies and the like. Then I happened to be working for the city during the city's mid-70s financial crisis. I decided I should go back to business school. Went to Harvard for my MBA, but always retained an interest in transportation. And I just kind of concluded when I was at Harvard that having worked as an engineer and looking at and designing transportation things, financing them would be kind of more interesting.
Tell me a little bit about your time with the city of New York in the mid-70s. As you mentioned, that was a pretty turbulent period.
Well, I think clearly when I started, which was probably in 1973-74 time frame with the city, the world was fairly stable then. Then I think toward the after about 2 years there, the financial problems started materializing. In many ways, it's almost a rerun of what's going on today where, costs were rising, the economy was slowing down, lots of pressure on the revenue side. The way a lot of cities at the time were balancing the budgets, probably reducing services, and I think going into deferred maintenance. And I argue a lot of the challenges that government's facing today and the country's facing and infrastructure is related to really not maintaining it. And I think it's kind of building up. And with the general poor economy, clearly that's put a lot of pressure on the revenue side. So, it's similar vein in the 70s. Not a lot of resources, a lot of demands.
When you were with the Transportation Administration, were you involved in issuing bonds and things like that?
No, it was more a classic planning group. We looked at traffic patterns and pedestrian movements. It was more of trying to manage the city's resources kind of to deliver transportation to the citizens.
Okay. So you were looking at the other side of that
right.
From a distance.
Right.
Okay, and that was the MBA took you in that direction.
It really was a master's degree. Then I went to get my MBA after I left the city.
Okay.
And then I came back, and I went because when I got out of Harvard, I decided, I kind of had the background in government. I kind of was always interested in transportation finance, so municipal industry seemed like a right combination of the two,
okay.
Where I could take advantage of my experience in the city as well as kind of my engineering bias and transportation. So if you look at the municipal marketplace, what most of the financings that the business industry does is really related to infrastructure, all types, whether it's, building, we build schools, bridges, tunnels, highways, hospitals and schools. So, airports, I always have a very strong interest in airports. There's a lot of airport finance done in municipals. So, it kind of was an interesting connection between my engineering experience, my city experience, and kind of what I want to do on the finance side.
So then you went into Smith Barney after that?
Started Smith Barney in 1978. The firm was officially Smith Barney Harris Upham. It was a mid to small size broker dealer specialized in municipal bonds and equities. The industry itself is a relatively small industry, pretty modest in size in terms of volume, nothing near what it is today. Deals were a lot smaller. So it was really almost like a little, I always characterize somewhat of a cottage industry, relatively small, a lot of competitors, not too much concentration in terms of any particular firm, so a lot of people in the business, but it was a pretty kind of little backwater business actually on Wall Street compared to what was going on.
Okay. And what was your role?
I started as an associate, and really, given the department I started at, it was very small, and the industry was kind of small. It was pretty much you did a little bit of everything on anything. So I kind of did all types of financings when I started. I was doing airports, turnpikes, public power transactions, did structured financings and housing and student loans. Cause pretty much you did everything because no sector was so big that really you could focus on it. So it was really more of you had to kind of got a chance to do a lot of different things.
Hmm. How did your experience with the city make you approach this differently than some of your colleagues?
Well, I think, you know, having worked for a city, you kind of understand what some of the drivers of government, what's like budgeting, what happens on the budgeting side, some of how the decision-making process works. I think you actually start appreciating government, people who work for government, because I think, you have very talented people who are very committed to their jobs, and I think, so you get a sense of what people are like that, how they think about things. I mean, I think a lot of themselves view themselves as, trustees to the city and their employers. So it's a very different, I think, mentality than the corporate side, because they're whether they're making progress and how they get measured is a lot different, much more difficult. The tangible things are a lot more complicated. And they clearly get involved in policy issues. So, I mean, it's pretty, they have a very complicated job. And I think having worked for the government, you start appreciating some of the challenges they go through, given their jobs and the really limited resources that cities and states have.
Yeah, that's interesting, that different mentality you talk about. Did that sort of brush off on the people in the industry who were working with them? I mean, did you see the bonds setting up, the municipal bond people taking a different approach because of that?
I think what you find in the public finance municipal side, especially on the banking side, is you have people who, clearly have very strong finance orientation. But to be successful, I think you have to understand budgeting. You have to understand municipal accounting. And I think you also have to have an appreciation of public policy issues. Because if you look at, unlike corporations where a lot of the investment and things they do is purely return-driven, in the government side, it's as much delivering services. And one of the challenges for government is trying to figure what's the value of a service. But there's certain services that government provides which are probably going to lose money from a, pure revenue cost basis, but they're part of the necessary functions of government. So it's a whole different mindset of why they do what they do. When you look at a bank, for example, like Citi, when it deploys or invests capital, it's return-driven. They look at risks and stuff like that. When a governmental body pursues a project, it's trying to provide a service, and it tries to provide it at the lowest possible cost. But it's not, the concept of returns really don't necessarily come back. So classic evaluations that you use in the corporate side of whether you deploy capital is never, it's hard to use that in the public sector.
Excellent. Well, given that this basis we've laid down, the difference in the industry,
right,
the size, you talk
right
about this being kind of a backwater. Take me through the 1980s and maybe into the 90s and what kind of transformations you saw.
Well, same thing. I think when I started in the late 70s, 78, industry volume, I think, was probably well below $100 billion a year. I think it was probably, probably $60, $80 billion a year. It's kind of interesting. Toward the latter half of the 80s, latter half of the 70s, you saw a couple of things happening. Clearly tax reform.
No, go ahead.
Tax reform, the IRS started changing rules on arbitrage and the like. The other thing that was kind of interesting was that in the early part of the 80s, the concept of municipal bond funds really got really developed. Early on, I think in the late 70s, the way income was treated on bond funds, it was treated as a dividend and therefore a taxable event. I think in the early 80s, they changed the rules such that a tax-exempt bond fund could distribute tax-exempt income on a tax-exempt basis, which is really a big change. And with that, you saw a real explosion in that pool of assets growing over time. And then I think commensurate with that growth in the asset base, people were looking for municipal bonds, and you saw a good growth in the municipal bond business. And I think a couple of things were going on. One is there were more creative uses of municipal bonds. There were a lot of single-family mortgage programs developed at that point for helping homeowners buy first-time mortgages. There were student loans. But I also think you started seeing the process of municipal government taking a larger and larger role in redeveloping infrastructure in the country. The population was growing. Schools had to be built. Highways, bridges, and the like. So I think there was a greater demand for capital. And I think it was very clear that the federal government was going to provide less and less money to build things, and it was going to defer a lot of the activity to the local communities. And I think that trend has continued clearly to this day, I think.
So this is maybe a political change that grew out of the reorientation of the 1980s.
Well, if you go back to the 1950s, for example, the federal government paid for the interstate system and built it, and really never provide for maintenance. I think over time, as cities have grown, infrastructure has grown, the feds have provided less and less money and required more in local matching, local activity. The problem at the end of the day is local communities really have don't have enough cash to provide all those resources. They started borrowing. And I think they started using the municipal markets as a way of raising capital to start building infrastructure. So if you look at the building of bridges, airports, late 70s, you had deregulation in the airline industry, so you saw an explosion in airport development. So you just saw, and the economy started picking back up in the 80s, so you saw that growth, and as populations expanded, you had to build more housing and more roads. So I think as you saw the population of the country shifting from, some of the Rust Belt states to the north, to the southeast and the west, as California's population grew, if the end of the day you look at the municipal industry, a large part of what drives its financings are growth, the building of infrastructure to meet population growth. So if you look at the shift in population to California and Florida and Texas, for example, out of the New Yorks and the Michigans and the Ohios, I think you see a pretty interesting migration pattern toward jobs, toward growth. And that areas that had little population began to grow dramatically, and then you had to meet the infrastructure needs. Phoenix, for example. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, as you're seeing the shift from the old Rust Belt states, New York, Pennsylvania, maybe who've been doing this for generations, down to the Sun Belt, are you seeing new approaches to financing come in at the same time?
I think the core, if you look at the core value of municipal finance and really most infrastructure development is, by and large, you can't issue bonds without a source of repayment. And in terms of the technology in the municipal industry, the products the core products are still fixed rate bonds, and I think the security structures are fairly straightforward. Variations on core themes, but clearly having revenues available to repay these things. By and large, we put them in two classes: general obligation debt, which is clearly a repayment obligation of a municipal government from all its available resources. But what we've seen dramatic shift toward is what we call revenue bonds, where specific revenues are earmarked to repay a series of bonds whose use of proceeds is also well defined. So it's almost becoming much more a user fee driven model. And I think in part that's because I think the citizens, I think, want to know where their money goes. The general, if you look at a general obligation bond, the voters approve the issue of the debt and they agree to pay for it from whatever available resources. When you issue revenue bonds, you have a much closer tie in between the revenue source and the use of the proceeds. And I think it's as much, most Americans would like to know where the money's going.
Right.
So if you're going to build a toll road, they know their tolls are being used to pay off the debt that was used to build toll roads, you know. So I think airport fees, same thing. So I think there's a much more of, I'd like to know where my money goes, and I'm willing to approve those fees as long as I see something, some value in exchange.
Right.
So I think you see a lot of that. So the revenue bonds, you know, 30 years ago, it was probably half revenue bonds, half TO bonds. Now it's probably 75-80% revenue bonds. So I think the trend toward user fees is fairly pronounced and has really been accelerating.
How about derivatives and things like that?
You know, if you go back to the basic model, it's really long-term fixed-rate bonds, right? Then in the early 80s, variable rate instruments started getting into the market and the product mix and into balance sheets of government. And that was as much driven by very low rates. Historically, short-term rates are lower than long-term rates. And because there's a certain expectation that if you have short-lived assets, you should have short-lived liabilities, so there was a matching. So that was an early innovation. I mean, commercial paper didn't show up in the municipal market till the early 80s. Variable rate bonds started showing up probably about, you know, that period. So that was kind of one of the first changes. I think things like auction rate bonds, derivative products and the like, were changes to the market that occurred as different issuers had, you know, had different specific financing needs and were looking for vehicles to take advantage of market opportunities as it relates to their enterprise. I think, like in anything in life, I don't think there's one size fits all. But I think, like everything else, it's a good tool properly used by people who have an understanding of what it achieves, right? And it's not a panacea to everything. But clearly, it provides certain benefits that some people have taken advantage of, I think, to great benefit.
Were these devised by the financial industry, sort of trying to meet their customers' needs?
You know, derivatives, I think, have been around a long time, probably much more prevalent in the corporate sector. I think in some ways it took a while to get into the municipal sector for a couple of reasons. One is just the nature of municipal credits are different, you know, than... You know, they're not allowed to file bankruptcy by and large. I mean, there's governance issues. And I think there are also many states have local finance rules that preclude them from doing certain things. So I think, so there was a whole evolution. I think going back to municipal issuers themselves, since their motivation is not profit, I think they clearly value safety above all else. And I think there clearly are, you know, derivatives are products that people need to understand about. That's why I think, same thing, it's not a panacea, it's not a one-size-fits-all. I think in the proper in the proper places with, you know, the knowledgeable and issuers who have the right balance sheet that can handle some of the risks associated with it, it's probably a fine product and it's very effective. I think that, you know, some of the problems that probably could arise is if just people, you know, just used it without really thinking about what the consequences were.
Mm-hmm. Excellent little primer there. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's look into your career a little bit. I assume you're moving up in Smith Barney at this point. Solomon Smith Barney.
I mean, you know, in some ways, if you look at the history of the department I've been involved, it's almost like a microcosm of Wall Street. I mean, I think I actually have lost track of how many firms I've been part of mergers with. I mean, the fascinating thing about our department is I've been in the same department 32 years now. The same department has been together as a group for that period of time. We have many people in our division from both the banking side and the capital market side who have actually been with this organization for 30 years. I mean, I've been here 32 years. You know, there are a couple people who have been here before me. Many of my you know, colleagues have been here 20s, high 25. I mean, if you look at Wall Street, the group, at least, that we have here is probably unusual in terms of the longevity in one department that has survived so many different mergers. You know, so same thing, we were Solomon Smith Barney, then we were acquired by Primerica, then then Sandy Wild, and Travelers, and Solomon Smith Barney, and I mean, it's been on and on, and now we're Citi.
How would you account for sticking together through all of that?
Well, I mean, if you look at, I mean, I think we've always run a very well-integrated business. I think we've always, as a department, been considered one of the stronger departments on Wall Street. You know, if you look at, you know, objective measures of league tables and the like, we've been, you know, we've been one of the leading firms. I think we've been the top-ranked firm for 14 consecutive years. I mean, so, I mean, we've, you know, I think we've had, we're recognized by both issuers as well as investors as being, you know, an active market leader. And I think so. I think, like anything else, excellence probably saves you a lot when there's a lot of turmoil. And I think it, you know, it's been a very solid business.
What you're describing here is a period of consolidation, and
in the industry,
others are consolidating too.
Right,
so you're
right.
Seeing some big competitors, UBS, right. Merrill.
Well, I mean, if you go back, I mean, if you go back not that many years, there were 10 or 12 major New York-based law, broker-dealer firms and municipals. Now, arguably, there are about a half a dozen. So I think you've seen huge consolidations in broker-dealer industry over the last 32 years. And I think what's going on, I mean, this one industry has kind of mirrored it. A lot of the firms that were very strong competitors when I started don't exist anymore or totally vacated business. First Boston, Prudential's really not that active. Kidder's gone. You know, Merrill Lynch, Bank of Merrill merged. Wachovia, Wells has merged. Bear Stearns is no longer around. First Boston's really out of the municipal business. I mean, the list is amazingly long. Solomon Brothers is gone. So a lot of the firms that were very active and very large participants in our market have since kind of disappeared, but not because of municipal business per se. It's more just the general consolidation on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. Now, your involvement in the industry, more general, I assume, would have broadened over time. TBMA, one of your first big involvements?
I first got involved in TBMA years ago. I was asked to join it as in the municipal group. I actually became head of the municipal division at that, you know, for, I served a year there. Then I got, you know, so I was active with that. You know, that's primarily an industry group. You know, deals with industry issues. I got involved a lot more in dealing with the MSRB at the time and, you know, some of the regulatory things. It was a good experience.
Had you been involved with the MSRB before that?
Not really.
There weren't instances in which you'd go down to Washington and talk to folks or something?
You know, I think, not that often, right? I mean, I knew Kit Taylor, who was the executive director at the time. I knew many of the people at the MSRB. We interacted a bit, but Not you know, on a regular basis.
When would you interact?
You know, I think the MSRB always tried to understand what was going on in the industry, you know, what people were up to, what was happening. So I think given our firm's position and kind of what I was doing, you know, every once in a while, you know, I'd hear from some people and I'd be kind of what's happening. So it's more as an informational resource, if you will.
At one of the points at which you start to become visible with the TBMA is when you're starting to look at more transparency in the secondary
right.
market. My sense is that some of this was driven by an SEC review of the market. Is that correct?
You know, I think the municipal market's always been interesting in that, unlike the corporate sector, which has EDGAR and SEC registration and the like. Because of the Tower Amendment, the municipal market's kind of been all its own little space, right? I mean, the fact that defaults are rare, very rare, and the amount of investors that have actually been hurt in the industry is so limited, I think it's never gotten the same level of attention and scrutiny that I think the corporate models and other markets have gotten. But it just seemed, when I started getting involved in this thing, is that the world was changing pretty dramatically. I think all markets going to be, you know, a lot closer to scrutiny from a regulatory perspective, and that we as broker-dealers had to kind of anticipate some of the changes, start moving toward, try to, you know, change the way things were being done, like moving much more toward electronic, making information much more readily available. I mean, there's a whole slew of changing regimes. I mean, clearly, I think when I started in the industry early on, it was, you know, still lots of paper, you know, very, you know, physical documentation, Electronic communication was really not a big factor. I mean, it's all dramatically changed. The internet was coming into place, which gave everybody a tool. And I think we just had to bring our industry much more into the forefront to basically take advantage of the technology.
Was it, certainly, was this the late 90s, early 2000s? Was that the time?
I think, you know, I mean, I kind of view it as the, you know, the mid-90s, this trend started changing.
And that really is the internet's taking off at that point.
Yeah, because, I mean, for many years the problem was distributing information. I mean, look, there, when I started, we were still, you know, hand-delivering things, and messenger services were running all over the place, right? I mean, clearly when you went to the internet, but I think we had to do that. The other thing is you could tell that a lot of municipal issuers were also getting much more sophisticated, and everyone was trying to find their own way of getting communications out. So there really wasn't a common platform, if you will. So when I got involved with TVMA, you know, we got involved in the municipal council, which was actually somewhat of a combination idea of a number of people. MSRB helped put together the first meeting, and it was a combination of all major market participants between issuers, investors, the broker-dealers through TVMA, the SEC. I mean, there were a lot of people involved in those early meetings.
Who was driving, bringing all of those groups together?
I think the original meeting was called by the MSRB. They reached out to some people. They provided a forum for at least the original meeting. But it was interesting that over time, I think the other parties came more involved. TVMA actually, I think, you know, we were one of the leaders of it. You know, provided some financial assistance to host meetings and the like.
Was this just a general call to get together and look at things, or was there one particular issue driving it?
At the time, I think the original premise was that we should get a number of all the people in the industry to kind of sit down and see what's bothering people. So I think I remember the first couple of meetings were just talking about different issues, what's out there, what's good, what should we focus on. I think it soon became very clear to people as the SEC was saying, look, we want better disclosure, we want secondary market. I mean, they were pushing toward more disclosure, and the group collectively concluded that there was no commonality and no unified effort to try to be responsive to the SEC's request. So I think where Muni Councils took a very active role and a lot of leadership was try to work through some of the issues relating to facilitating information and secondary market disclosure. I mean, the MSRB was already working on its own to start collecting official statements and the like and collecting trading information, but it seemed to all of us that that wasn't dealing what issuers needed to do.
Why not?
Well, you know, that, you know, same thing. The MSRB really was focused on the broker-dealer side because of the Tower Amendment, they could only regulate broker-dealers. So the issuers kind of also knew that they had to kind of do more. And look, a lot of issuers actually had a lot of information, but they were trying to figure out how to get it out to investors in a common way. I think it was too much everybody was doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. And I think you really need to start unifying it on an industry-wide basis. So I think what was interesting about the Muni Councils, you got issuers, you got investors, you got the broker-dealers all involved talking about some of the issues. The SEC had created the NERMSRs, the filing systems. One of the early initiatives that we had was to try to figure out how those were working, if they were working at all. We actually had a bunch of NERMSRs come in providing information about a specific issuer just as a case point. It was fascinating to us when you sat in a room and all these people sat through listening to the presentations. It was very clear there was no standard. Everybody had their own system. If you were an investor, you'd had a terrible time figuring it out. The broker-dealers were really obligated to make sure before they did any business they had checked all those sites, and it was a very unwieldy system.
And they had to pay as well, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, they were buying the services and all. So the whole system was... I think the basic premise of having better information, more information was fine, but the delivery systems were never put in place. And I think the SEC left it to the private sector to develop it, but without any standards. It was a classic case. Everybody had a different idea. Everybody had a different model. It's kind of like the old days with videotapes. You had the Sony and the VHS. So it's that kind of thing. There were multiple technologies going on. And I think it was clear from sitting through that process, and everybody in the room saw it, like this was not really going to be helpful to anyone. So the Muni Council started the initiative, got Texas Mac involved. We started trying to...
Texas Mac?
Yeah. Create a system, you know, that ultimately became CUSIP-based to be able to track information and the like. And I think that, you know, look, that got some following. I think it made... But I think it was very clear... That was done on a volunteer basis, and it needed to be rolled into a mandatory system. But I think the work of the Muni Council and TVMA with Texas MAC and that group, I think, really provide the basis for what became the EMMA system in MSRB. Okay.
This is your central post office.
CPO.
Something we didn't mention is where this peculiar system you talk about with the NRMSRs and all that came from. Now, was this...
That was SEC.
Was this out of the mid-90s?
Well, I think as they started a regime about secondary market information, disclosure, and the like, they created the concept of it. But I think what they were having difficulty doing it, I don't think the SEC wanted to house it themselves. I think there was a sense, at least from the commission's perspective, that the private sector could do it better. And I think they asked people to create, you know, be designated as NRMSRs and the like. And I think there were four of them, and then there were also state repositories. But it became a very unwieldy system. And the same thing, you could have one transaction that was really, if you will, booked five different ways, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were an investor trying to find information, you'd have to understand how each system had its own organizational structure and fit to find data. So it was very inefficient, and it was inconsistent, which is very clear.
Now, wouldn't the big professional investors have perhaps benefited from a system like this? Because with experience, you might know how to understand it a little better than the amateurs, so to speak.
I think the professional investors for a period of time actually were developing their own systems, internal back office, if you will, infrastructure to monitor different, you know, borrowers, municipal issuers, in part because they had no options. But I think, you know, even though there were NRMSRs, the consistency with which everyone collected information was all over. Filings were very inconsistent. You know, it was just not a system anyone could easily figure out. You had Bloomberg was in there. So there were a number of different people who had a different system. Certain people had better technology than others. But I think the common complaint, I think, of a lot of investors was, well, it's not that easy to find. And issuers, I think, tried to make sure they filed all of them. It was hard to tell what happened to them. And this was also a period of time when people were delivering paper documents. So, I mean, a lot of these NRMSRs were spending an incredible amount of time just converting paper documents to electronic form. So it was, you know, look, it was clearly at the early part of the technology breakthrough in information technology and paper processing and all that. So I think you had a lot of factors, a little bit of a good-intentioned SEC creating set of rules, but the technology not being placed to deliver it efficiently.
Right.
And I think the CPO was kind of, I think, the first step to at least try to articulate in a single environment what kind of things you need to have to help that information flow. It was a good test bed because investors got to comment about how it worked, it didn't work. Issuers got comments. So it, I think, provided a lot of core information and expertise and knowledge, and just the workings of the municipal market. Before then, CUSIPs were kind of there, but not a vehicle for filing things. You know, one of the things Muni Council did is clearly get the CUSIP system to agree to let us use CUSIPs as a vehicle, start indexing bonds against.
Did somebody own the CUSIP system?
CUSIPs was owned by, I think, the American Bankers Group, so that was kind of an interesting conversation we had with them. A number of the issuers got very involved with us, you know, TBA and CUSIP, and kind of negotiated, and they kind of came around to work with us.
They develop a licensing system or something?
They actually CUSIPs are, if you will, a license place on bonds. There are several million CUSIPs out there. You actually have to go to the CUSIP bureau to buy a CUSIP number, right? And there were patent issues, their naming. I mean, there were a whole slew of things that we worked our way through with them. I mean, look, they were very cooperative. They worked with us. They kind of knew that they were going to, they had to, kind of, it was important for the industry overall. Because for many years, you know, if you go back to the NURMSAs, a lot of the filings at NURMSAs were done alphabetically. So some organized it by state of issue, some issuer name. So it was just all over. When you have a QCIP, it cuts through all those various ways and gives you one way to tie bonds together.
How long had that system been around?
QCIPs?
Yeah.
QCIPs have been around actually for, I think, as long as I can remember.
Okay. But it sounds like the NURMSAs weren't really using it.
No.
Okay.
Because at the time they were created, QCIP numbers belonged to QCIP. So okay. It wasn't until, because it was interesting, when we got MuniCounts together, we looked at all the different ways of doing, and the only thing that everyone knew that no one would disagree about, everyone knew what a QCIP number was. And there was only one QCIP number for a particular bond issue. So it became clear that if you were going to try to have a common base, QCIPs were pretty good. Was the way to go, and getting them to agree to was important. And then, and because, you know, issuers knew what their QCIP number is, investors got told what their QCIP number was. If you actually look at a brokerage account, they tell the QCIP number. You know, official statements, you know, QCIP numbers now integrated in official statements. So the whole system is really kind of concluded that's the best way to tie a myriad of information together, and I think that was clearly one of the things the Muni Council helped establish, is that that was the best mechanism.
Now, this would seem like a pretty big project for a voluntary group like yours to put this CPO together.
It was a lot of work.
Tell me about the process and who you worked with.
Well, you know, Clue, you know, I mean, TBMA was good because we actually provided some financial resources to help it out. We had issuers through GFOA that were actually very active. You know, they were helping out, working through these things.
GFOA,
Government Finance Officers Association. Different industry investor groups came in. So, I mean, a lot of people, look, I mean, what's interesting about the group is even though they had represented different parties to the thing, they all kind of understood there are things that the municipal marketplace had to do to get it better. Mm-hmm. And to kind of start getting up to, you know, the level of sophistication it really deserved. And so I think everybody worked together. And it really was a volunteer. People spent an incredible amount of time at it. I mean, I think they worked very hard. They were very dedicated to it. And I think it kind of speaks a lot of just the nature of the people in the industry. Even though arguably we're on different sides of the trade, I think people work very hard together to kind of make it successful.
You talked about there probably being, while people are working together, they see a common problem. There's going to be tensions between the issuers and the underwriters and things like that. What were some of those natural tensions?
Well, you know, I think, you know, if you look at the municipal industry itself, clearly municipal issuers are not regulated. Municipal broker-dealers are regulated. Investors are subject to different rules because they have fiduciary obligations to their customers, being investors. So I think, you know, where because of the diverse nature of municipal issuers, it's always hard. I think we as the banking side kind of always accepted the fact that there's no one-size-fits-all theory. That diversification, the diversity of number of municipal issues, type of issues, what they do, what they don't do, how frequently they respond, is so broad, given there are about 80,000 issuers in the U.S., that you had to be much more sensitive than not trying to create these one-size-fits-all solutions. You know, so things like content of disclosure. You know, we clearly, you know, it seemed to us very difficult to create a standard content because each enterprise is different. So what we were really focusing on from the broker-dealer side is create mechanisms to facilitate the transfer of information from the issuers who had it to the investors who wanted it to, in the truth, avoid dictating content, right?
Mm-hmm.
The investors themselves had kind of position papers of what they thought would be appropriate information, but what we tried to do, at least on the broker-dealer side, is just say, look, we want to facilitate the communications, right? You as an issuer have to decide what's relevant. You have an investor have to decide what's relevant on your part. You guys work it out, but what we want to do as a broker-dealer is make sure that to the extent an issuer decides to go to the effort of making information available, and the investor needs it, that we find a common place where that interchange can occur.
Right.
So we were really more working about the infrastructure and the pipeline, if you will, to connect the user, the endpoints.
It seems like it would inevitably, the question of wanting to control and keep the amount of, keep it reasonable, and then the desire to want all the disclosure you get would land in your lap at some point.
Right. Well, we became the interface between the two parties. But because there are so many different type of enterprises, that we'd be hard pressed to say, well, there's one way to do this.
Right.
So that's why we are kind of our view or our bias is much. Let's facilitate the communications. Right. It's kind of like pipeline companies. Right. I mean, you know, the pipeline connects one point to another point, whether you're running gasoline through it or jet aviation fuel or oil or cooking. I mean, whatever. Right. The pipelines are within levels pretty indifferent of what you push through the system, but they are a facilitator of exchanges.
Okay.
Right.
And as the Muni Council, you don't really have a regulatory role,
no.
So you don't have to weigh in on that.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
Anything else we should touch on with the creation of the CPO and the Muni Council?
No, I think, Texas MAC was very important. They invested an incredible amount of time. I think it was a good testbed for it.
Why did they take that project on?
Well, it's kind of Texas MAC actually was a NERMSER in Texas. They were a base state repository, so they actually had a system where they were providing information to investors and issuers in the state of Texas. You know, to a smaller scale, what we were trying to accomplish on a national scale. So they had the expertise. Texas MAC actually is an organization funded by broker dealers in the state of Texas. So they were almost like a TBMA, a mini version if you want a regional basis. So they actually had the expertise. You know, they're a broker-driven group also. So I think it was actually easy for TBMA to work with Texas MAC because, they were almost like a, subset of, because TBMA is a national organization and Texas MAC is funded by Texas broker-dealers. So, I think the DNA, if you will, is very consistent. And it was something that we had talked to the board at Texas MAC about getting involved. And since they were all municipal bankers, they kind of knew what was going on, and they were very supportive of the TBMA effort. So I think it was pretty straightforward.
Apparently they had the resources to tackle something.
Well, they had financial resources. SIPMA had financial resources. I think really, at the end of the day, the broker-dealers invested a fair amount of money and time in the whole process. TBMA got help. TBMA provided we got funding from the overall organization to afford it. Texas MAC, committed some resources as well, which is basically funded by broker-dealers. So the broker-dealer community actually, I think, through Texas MAC as well as TBMA, helped, finance the Muni Council initiatives and get the thing started.
Okay. So at that period, you're moving from the 90s into the 2000s, and I assume that you're seeing continued change in the municipal bond market.
Well, volume was growing dramatically. I think the number of issues kept growing. The type of transactions were getting, larger, more sophisticated. I think there was clearly growing pressure on all regulatory bodies and all markets for better transparency, more information. I think total aggregate municipal bonds grew from substantially less than $2 billion to well over $2 billion in a relatively short period of time. So the whole world expanded very, very quickly.
Are you seeing individuals get into municipal bonds?
Well, municipal bonds, if you go back to the core, which is tax and bonds, I think the only people who actually use tax exemption are individuals. So probably about a third of the bonds are held directly by individuals, another third are held by individuals through bond funds and conduits, so they're like proxies. So the market is probably about two-thirds, retail, give or take. Then you have property and casualty companies and banks and the like on the other part. I mean, until the BABs were done, which dramatically broadened municipal bonds, it was primarily Build America bonds, which are taxable bonds with a federal subsidy. Until that happened, really, people who bought municipal bonds, by and large, needed the tax exemption, which were retail. There was a period of time in the, late in the 90s and the 2000s when there were these things called tender option bonds created, which are really certain certain entities were created to buy long-term municipal bonds, finance it short-term, and create an economic benefit through that process. But that, you know, they were dominant probably in the mid-2000s, and then they have ceased to become active because of the changes in the market and the like. But you saw a dramatic explosion in volume, activity, demand for more and more information.
How about negotiated markets?
The split between negotiated and competitive has, over a fairly long period of time, been relatively stable. You have some variations, but I think it's about 2/3 to 3/4 of the market is negotiated. The balance is competitive.
Was that always the case, or did that change?
Early on, I mean, when you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, it was probably almost the other way around.
Okay.
But I think when you went back to revenue bonds and user fee-driven transactions, the negotiated bonds for those became much more prevalent because they were old stories. There was a lot more explaining to do. Explaining the credit, creating the structures, getting to investors, kind of telling them how it worked and all. A general obligation bond, at some levels, are fairly straightforward. You just have to decide whether you believe the region or whatever you're looking at is viable and diversified. When you start getting revenue bonds, it does require a lot more detailed understanding. So those predominantly are done negotiated.
So it sounds like moving into the 2000s then, the big thing that's happening is just the growth. And the growth is putting more pressure on transparency.
Right. Well, there's that, and also you're trying to also, you know, as there are more buyers, people want more information. So the whole thing was growing at different levels. And also the same thing with the Build America bond explosion, more and more new people coming to the market and are also looking for information. And you have people who historically who have bought taxable bonds, which have a whole different disclosure regime because they're drawing large corporate-related credits, going to municipal bonds where they didn't have that same kind of disclosure regime. So you have that going on. So there are a lot more, I think, demands for information and ready access to information.
So, and this is about the time you go into the MSRB then?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what the role of a board member, because you were just a board member for a couple of years, right?
I was on the board for 3 years. I was a board member. I was on the board for 3 years. I was chairman of my last year. I mean, you know, you start with the MSRB itself, right? It's a rulemaking body. It doesn't really enforce rules. You know, FINRA does the enforcement. It kind of works clearly and closely with the SEC. They're kind of the one we report back to. But because of the nature of the municipal industry, you don't regulate issuers. You regulate broker-dealers. So it's kind of an interesting position that it's trying to influence an entire market when he only has control over one piece of it, right? Responsibility. It really didn't regulate investors either. So it didn't regulate investors. It didn't regulate issues, but it did regulate the broker dealers. So I think you have to have a good appreciation of what that really entails and what you can and cannot do. So, but I think the MSRB is a fascinating organization. I think the board members, given the makeup at the time I was there, you know, you had a lot of people who knew about the industry. So, you know, I mean, the board was 15 people at the time, 5 banks, 5 broker dealers, 5, you know, public members. Public members were constrained in terms of you had to have an issuer and the like. But, I mean, it was a very interesting group of people, lots of diversity in terms of what they knew, understanding. Everyone brought their own kind of history and knowledge to the table. But I think it tried to work in a way that was responsive to the changing industry, given its limited powers.
What was the focus at that point when you came in? What were the people in the MSRB talking about?
I think early on, there were a lot of things happening in terms of what the MSRB could do and what it couldn't do, like the whole question of powers. I think we were also making some decisions about the leadership of the organization at the time. You know, Kit was the executive director, so that was happening.
He'd been the executive director for quite some time, right?
17, 18, yes, very long time. He actually was like, I think, the second. He started in the, probably the 70s. So I got, you know, I think he had been there, yeah, a very, very long time. But, you know, the industry had changed. It, you know, kind of grown a lot more pressure on sophistication of what it needed to do. I mean, it was moving because of the requirement for secondary market trading information, which was collecting and collecting data, to be almost more than just a rulemaking organization, to be much more information facilitator and houser of things.
Was there any, there's 15 people, you would think there would have been differences on what the proper role of the MSRB is, and was that one of the issues of contention?
You know, I think within the four corners, if you will, of what the what the MSRB was empowered to do, I think there was really no question about that. I think the challenge that always is, as the MSRB, you know, what is your role vis-a-vis the industry? I mean, how much of it is just writing rules about products you or activities you directly regulate, and how much do you try to influence activities around those on the margin, right? And I think that's really that was really the big debate in the board. The good news is I think a lot of things were debated, but I think nothing was really done during my tenure that people weren't on board on. I mean, the good news about the board is, you know, even everybody had a different opinion, everybody had a different viewpoint, background, but people were more than willing and able to articulate their views. I think everything got a good hearing, and I think there was a broad consensus arrived at what's the right approach for the board.
Okay, but it sounds to me like it must have been a bit of a challenge to reorient a little bit,
yeah.
To make expand the board's influence, if not its actual.
Well, cool. Like I said, I mean, early on it was primarily rule writing, right? Then it became almost more a technology platform. So that became a larger and larger part of what it did, right? Because, I mean, I think the rulemaking part, it's a very well-defined process, right? When you deal with data, especially things like trade data and the like, which are very real-time activities, the total service orientation is different. You actually have customers who are using your data. Yeah, you know, so the whole premise of that organization changed pretty dramatically. And I think the truth is one of the things that the board was challenged to do is figure out, okay, how do we want to organize the board going forward in the face of some of the demands on it?
Okay.
You know, and that's in part, you know, some of the things that I think in truth is ultimately, you know, I think, you know, Kit, you know, basically left the MSRB. We brought Lynette on, so I was there during the period of time when we were phasing out one executive director, starting a new one, and taking on a bunch of new initiatives. So
okay.
I think there were some major changes in the MSRB, but I think there were necessary changes because the environment was changing, and the expectation about the MSRB, about its role, was changing.
Okay.
I think in the past, I think it was a little more passive about just as a rulemaking body. Now it became really an active part of the market because of the data it had, and it's kind of became the crossroads for a lot more information. And that's why I think one of the big things we started was the MS system, because it was very clear that the CPO, while it had accomplished a lot, really needed a much broader financial base to help kind of continue its development, and that to the extent the SEC agreed that it needed, some of this stuff had to be done on a mandatory basis for broker-dealers versus just a voluntary basis, you really needed it to be housed in a more regulatory-type vehicle, which
right.
is why the MSRB became the appropriate candidate.
Well, before we jump into that and sort of roll through that,
sure.
that process, were there, during the first couple of years, were there rulemaking issues were there initiatives that stand out at that point?
Well, there were, I mean, we had early on, before I got there, they had G37, the G38 thing started coming up about consultants. We continually looked at the G23 finance advisors. There's an ongoing, you know, conversation. You know, there was always clarifications of different things. So there was always an ongoing activity on the rulemaking side, you know, which, you know, clearly the staff was, that was that was clearly their DNA prior to that period of time was focused on that, and they were good at it. I mean,
how did the process work? Was the SEC consulted?
Well, I think historically what the board, through feedback from either broker-dealers or just parties in the market, would kind of become aware of an issue, or because of the board members themselves would raise issues that would be talked about. You know, I think the staff would be very helpful in kind of researching some of them from a legal perspective as well as market practice. So by and large, there's a process trying to identify a specific area. There's internal drafting of documents. There's briefings to the board. Once the board agree, you know, it's the staff and the board agree of what rules, if any, have to be written, the language of it, then they're put out for public comment and things like that, and you go through that process, then the SEC gets it and they put it out for comment before formal adoption. So there's a process. Some of those are just really redefining practices, kind of providing information about what the expectation of the rulemakers were as to how the broker-dealers behaved and things like that. So a lot of that was going on. The G37 and G38 was trying to eliminate the perception of untoward activity in the broker-dealer community as it relates to that market. So things like that were done.
Yeah, we haven't talked about pay-to-play at all, and that was, you know, from a public standpoint, that was the big story back then.
Well, that was done, I guess, in the early 90s, so the G37 rules. But, you know, like, look, I think it was one of those things that I think the industry concluded, and rightly so, that it was noise around a business that I think was distracting people from the business itself, and cleaning that whole area up, I think, was really a positive for the broker-dealer business. So I think, you know, that was one of those classic things. Was it illegal? Probably not, but I think it was clearly a perception issue. Mm-hmm. And I think the board wanted the broker-dealers to be much more sensitive to their perception of their role in the market.
Well, let's move into your chairmanship. And you've talked a little bit about somewhat of a reorientation of the perspective, the outlook of the MSRB. Did you sort of get interested in taking over the chairmanship? How did that go to you?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think it's an honor to be on the MSRB itself, to be chairman. I think it's even doubly so. It was something I was interested in. I talked to some of the board members about my interest. They were very supportive of it. They thought it made sense. You know, then they, so, you know, I was, you know, was fortunate enough to be selected as the chairman. Lynette had come in. I had known her from my TBMA days. So we had a partnership going back well before then. So it was kind of interesting, and, you know, so I think clearly getting the opportunity with a new executive director was pretty fascinating. And I think given the fact that Lynette and I had worked a lot on Muni Council to get the CPO thing, it just seemed pretty natural to put that high in the list of things the MSRB should kind of engage in and kind of push to kind of implement. The other thing we also spent a lot of time in first year with Lynette, because she was also the new executive director, was really establish with our market participants, whether they're investors, the issuers, and the SEC and the like, a much more cordial and communicative type of relationship between the MSRB and them.
How do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, we spent a lot of time meeting with people, doing a lot of outreach. We did community outreach visits with broker-dealers around the country. You know, we sat down with the GFOA folks, which we knew well from the Muni Council. You know, we had a lot of meetings with the SEC folks. You know, we met with the commission, the chairman of the SEC and all, just to kind of make sure they know who we were, that, you know, Clay wanted. At the end of the day, the MSRB wanted to be helpful to regulators, because clearly that's who we work for, and we're a rulemaking board, but also to market participants, that we're really trying to do things that were helpful to make the market more efficient and really, you know, continue to mark the integrity of the market. We didn't want the MSRB to be viewed as not working for their interests, right? Because you always run into a problem where, the perception is a rulemaker is trying to basically be punitive with all the participants, and that was really not the intention. The intention was, Municipal Mark does some very good things. It's helpful to issuers. It finances infrastructure. It's a good investment vehicle for investors. So it has a lot of good benefits, and I think the job of the MSRB was really to make sure that it ran as well, as efficiently as it could, you know, with a high level of integrity and, you know, focus on doing the right thing. And I think it was important to have those outreaches. And, you know, and because Kit had been the exec director so long and Lynette was new, it was important to get her in front of these people so they'd have a, you know, a much better personal understanding of what the MSRB was.
Now, when you went out and you talked to folks, did you talk about this idea of more transparency and how you hope to accomplish that?
Well, I think, you know, you know, each group obviously had a little different interest. But I think what was the beauty of the MS system as it came to become was that it helped everyone, right? Because issuers, you know, if you take the issuer, for example, you know, clearly they say, well, we work hard to get our disclosure available, you know, we follow GASB rules. I mean, you know, they work very hard to make information available, and it seemed that this gave them a way to say, look, this is a good vehicle to make sure that all the hard work you put into making disclosure available actually gets to the people you intend them to get. The investor side was almost, so they had this huge need for information, and same thing, we were providing a free system for which they could access all the information they wanted. So, you know, clearly they, and we tried to clearly avoid with the investors or with issuers to talk about content. I said, look, you guys got to talk to your end users about what's the right information, but now we'll give you a vehicle that you as an issuer can get into it for free, you as an investor get information out for free, you know, and it seemed to us a win-win. So I think we clearly tried to address how the system would benefit their own particular needs, and they are a little different.
Mm-hmm. This is... you're calling this the Muni Edgar, I think it is, back
right.
in the early period. And at the same time, there's other things floating around, and I'd appreciate a little clarification
mm-hmm.
on,
sure.
on which came first and how they fit together. You had something called access equals delivery.
That was, if you go back years ago, clearly official statements, which are the primary marketing tool, had to be printed, so you had books. And you had to deliver books to customers, and no, you couldn't nearly execute a transaction without physically delivering books to customers, right? I mean, that became expensive for issuers because they had to print it. It became expensive for issuers because they had to deliver these books. So, I mean, it was a fairly inefficient system. What access equal delivery became was taking full advantage of the internet and electronic communications and electronic documents, which basically said, look, if you are offering securities, as long as any investor has the ability to access that document in electronic form, you don't have to physically give them a book. That's
okay.
All you had to do.
So that covers the sale.
Right. That covers, well, it covers the offering period as well as the actual sale of securities.
Okay.
Right. So electronic, that was a full adoption of electronic documents versus physical documents.
Now, did you have that program that set up before?
Well, what was interesting is early on, a lot of the paper documents were scanned to create electronic documents. What that was dramatically changed is that printers, in effect, printed very few books after that for a transaction, and primarily created electronic mediums, so PDF files. And then as long as we had PDF files, we could, you know, you could offer security. So it became hugely less expensive.
Okay.
Right. So we could distribute, you know, a million documents, you know, to a million investors electronically versus
mm-hmm.
physically having to get a book. So it was a huge cost savings.
Okay. But this is something that had been working on previous to...
Well, the corporate market already had it. So it seemed to us we should fully adopt it. The hardest thing... in truth, was working with issuers to figure out whether their documents were easily convertible to electronic form. Right? If you look at an official statement, you know, clearly there's the core document piece, which is created by the issuer. Then there are other parts that come from accountants or other pieces. When you're putting a book together, it was fairly straightforward. When you start putting electronics together, are they all in the same media and things like that? So that took a little bit. But same thing, I mean, accounting statements were going in electronic form anyway, so I think clearly took full advantage of the dramatic change in technology and word processing capabilities and the like.
Okay. one other thing.
Sure.
NIIDS. New issues. The Central Depository Trust Corporation is running something with new issues.
Right. That I think that's the system for... let me think about this one. NIIDS. I forget what that is.
What's it called?
I didn't write down the long name, but it's the Central Depository Trust, and MSRB is sort of consulting. But it's overlapping in this big area where you're starting to, take things electronic.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, we were trying to move the industry from paper to electronic form. So they're kind of like a central clearinghouse for documents.
Sounds like that wasn't an MSRB really thing.
That was more a coordination thing, but that was not a big driver.
There are just so many things that are in the mix at this point.
It's like anything else. I mean, it's every system is pretty complicated. There are a lot of pieces to it. You have to make sure the whole system works pretty seamlessly. Mm-hmm. And I think, as you say, you go from a document, paper, physical delivery system to electronic, and there are a lot of pieces you start finding out about, right? And that's really one of the biggest changes. But I think, we were definitely fortunate that the electronic era was moving very quickly at the same time we were trying to move. Right? If we had tried this initiative a decade ago, it would have been impossible because the technology wasn't there.
Right.
So I think it was fully trying to take advantage of the benefits of modern technology.
Okay. Let's go into a few of the challenges that you must have had setting up Emma. Getting this thing going. And one of the big ones is that my understanding is before this, disclosure is not necessarily mandatory in many respects. I mean, you can send things to the NURMSRs and all that, but you're talking about moving in that direction. So you'd think the issuers would kick back a little bit on that.
Well, look, I think, a couple of things. One is we had to get the SEC to agree that the MSRB should be the sole NURMS filing point, right? Because same thing, I think historically the SEC's view is we should have multiple filing points and let it be a private sector initiative. I think it became clear, having gone back through it and watched what was actually happening, that while that was a nice goal, that if you didn't have some consistency in how you approached it, a lot of the benefits of facilitating disclosure would be lost by the complexity of everyone having their own system. So I think what we at the MSRB had to prove is that our technology worked and what really the benefits of consolidating all in the MSRB. So that was clearly the SEC had to be comfortable that their requirements for disclosure really met by having, in effect, a regulatory body like the MSRB do it. So that was important. The other thing, I think issuers were also, because of the Tower Amendment, that because they are not regulated, having the MSRB, which is a rulemaking body, would somehow become de facto regulation. So I think it was important for them to understand. That's why we clearly avoided content. We're not a content driver. We're a facilitator of information flows. And I think they, we clearly tried not to tell them we're going to basically regulate you on a backdoor basis, right? The broker-dealers were also concerned, clearly, because once we had all that trade information, were we being used as a vehicle to basically, monitor their activity? I mean, so they had, so everybody had their own little skepticism about what the role was, but same thing, I think the argument for having the MSRB take over that role and the technology that we were bringing to the table was, I think, so compelling that a lot of those concerns took a little time to explain it through, but once they became aware of it, I think a lot of those concerns were dispelled.
How about the NURMSRs? You're talking about putting them out of business more.
Well, clearly they were not happy about it, but I think also they found out that I think the amount of time they were spending converting paper documents to electronic form, I think at the end of the what I think most of my sense is a lot of them view is the reason they got into that business was the fact that they thought they could repackage the data and sell it, right, on a commercial basis. And one of the things Emma did was really, it didn't really repackage the product. It just consolidated information. So actually the NURBSers, through a feed, could take the same data we had, reorganize it, and instead of spending their time converting documents to electronic form, you know, we argued with them that this would give them the ability to take a lot more data and really manage it and package it better for end users, so that they could create true value added by organizing the data rather than collecting it.
Did it work out that way?
You know, I think our sense is that some of them have actually done that. Others, I think, have just decided that they don't want to do it. So I think it's a little bit of everything. Like anything, the shift in the paradigm, you know, does create opportunities as well as eliminate other things. So I think it's a little bit of both. But anyway, what we argued with all of them, which they finally conceded it was probably accurate, the value added shouldn't be in collecting data. The value added should be in repackaging, manipulating it, and reorganizing it for users. And I think most of them kind of agreed at the end of the day and saw that. But I think the trauma, I think, of what we were doing, I think, clearly caused them a lot of concern for a while.
And the central post office, the CPO, you're just looking at sort of supplanting that entirely, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, Texas MAC got out of it. They were very helpful to us. You know, whatever files they had, they transferred over to us. So they've really gone back to the Texas MAC model, and they do what they do in the state of Texas now. So they've really gotten out of that whole process. Because when they were involved, it was voluntary, more of a test. Now it's mandatory, and the MSRB has it. So, but they were very helpful.
And that would seem to be the sticking point, that now it's mandatory part. And it took the SEC to do that.
Yeah, they had to do that from the broker dealer side. We also had to make sure the investors and everybody else was on board. But same thing, you know. I mean, look, anything because right now, the secondary market filing activity, you know, they had to do that, and they had to do some NURBS so that took care of that. Right. I think what we've done with Emma is also make it much more useful for primary market issuance as well, and the trade data, and so a lot of that thing. So it's really become a one-stop shopping point portal for information about municipal bonds.
Right. There's two ways. It seems like they could have, MSRB had this written into the legislation, the 75 Act amendments. It seems like this could have been done with legislation. You could have changed the function of the MSRB that way. And the other approach was for the SEC to do it with rules. Was there interest from legislators on this front?
You know, I think since the SEC wrote the rule about secondary market and created NURBSers, it seemed to us it was easier to create one NURBSer, right, than go through the whole process. I mean, because they already had everything in place. They identified the need for a NURBSer. They had created a bunch. But there was nothing that said they had to have one or five. So I think it was much more the policy perspective of letting private sector do it. But I think once they kind of were, you know, convinced, as we were, that having multiple NURBSers really didn't serve really the best interest of what the whole intent of the secondary market disclosure initiatives were, I think it was easier just to modify the SEC.
Okay. So you're looking at the simplest solution.
It's more of a simple solution. And from a congressional perspective, I think they're all for better disclosure, better transparency. So really, we never really got any pushback from any on the Congress side. It was more trying to figure what's the most effective way to implement.
Okay. And this is all going through, I think, through 2008 or so. This is transpiring. And I was intrigued. It seems as if, you know, Chairman Cox, he definitely makes some clear statements. But he takes a while to really jump on board and say, we're going to change this rule so that you can do this. Is that really what was going on?
No, I mean, I think we always had support, but also I think the SEC wanted to make sure that our technology is going to... I mean, what they wanted to do is avoid what happened in NURBS, which is they imposed a rule and the technology wasn't there. What they wanted to do is get some comfort that when they decided to proceed, that it could be transparent Right, so we actually did, there was a lot of testing done, there was a lot of initiative, you know, because we were basically rolling out a new product. And, like, the last thing you need in any new rollout is find out the day you opened the build, you turned the key on, it didn't work, right? So I think there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of concern on their part, which is fair, to make sure that all of their expectations of what the system could do were met. So, you know, we met a lot. There was a lot of time spent on the technology side of it.
Who were you working with closely at the SEC?
Well, you know, Martha Haynes was the municipal contact. You know, she was in charge of that area. So we spent a lot of time with her. You know, it was a good look. I think everybody had the same interest, but also no one wanted to have a system that didn't work. So I think everyone had to be comfortable that it did, in effect, did what it promised.
Right.
So the answer, some of the delay was in part getting through that. Because, you know, with the whole technology, you want to make sure it's all the little gremlins you're trying to find and test it. So there was a lot of testing.
Okay.
There was a lot of work done to make sure it worked seamlessly when it was turned on, which I think it did.
Okay, that makes sense. And that explains the way it
you know, it wasn't, there was never a fundamental disagreement with us and the SEC about what needed to be done. It was much more to make sure that, you know, when the implementation was done, it worked.
Okay. The only other complication then is the financial crisis that comes in right about the time you're rolling this thing out.
You know, the good news is that, in truth, is in some ways the financial crisis heightened the need for information. So I think, the MSRB funding is volume driven, so as long as there was any activities there were financial resources in the MSRB at the time. So the good news is the staff was able to focus on it, and I think in some ways the fact that it was coming on at the time did really provide more information for people rather than less. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot more information how the markets were behaving. I think it gave all the parties to the market a little better insight of how things were working or not working. I mean, the trade data was very helpful. So I think overall, actually, the timing of it was interesting when it happened, but it really never slowed down because of it. And I think in some ways it was actually viewed as being very helpful because of it.
I would have thought that you'd have gotten you would have gotten sidetracked with what was happening in the bond market.
No, it worked out okay because, I mean, the staff that was committed to implement was, you know, that was their job. They were focused on getting that done. The other issues, in some ways, really, the MSRB really had no control. I mean, you know, people were following the rules. It's just the market. There were aberrational activities in the market, right? That really, there's not much you could do about it. So I think we were just monitoring to make sure there weren't too many oddities happening. But, the focus on getting MSRB implemented was pretty clear, and the staffing was in place and the budgets and stuff, so...
Was EMMA completely implemented when you left as chairman?
It was very near the end.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the financial, you know, and what happened to the auction rate bonds and all of that stuff. And you explained that there's really not much that you can do. But on the other hand, you sort of set yourself up as this person who's working with the whole industry. So did you end up going out and doing, you know, fact-finding or consulting or anything?
Where we got involved very actively is on the auction, on the trade data. Because if you go, for a long time, the trade data only looked at long-term bonds. And one of the things we started doing the trade data is really roll it into the short-term money markets to make sure there's a lot more reporting of activity and transparency in all sectors of the market. So I think, same thing, you know, I think what we tried to do as the holder of data of trading activity was making sure that all sectors were more covered. So what we tried to do is broaden the availability of information by bringing more sectors into it. On the theory that the original system was designed for long-term bonds because the assumption is money markets really were not that much going on. And what the financial crisis showed is that it affected all markets, and probably actually the short-term markets were more volatile than the long markets. So one of the things we tried to do is broaden the database. So, you know, in response to that, we dramatically increase the number of things in the short in the reporting database. And that took a little bit because money market structures are trading differently and stuff, so there's a lot more. So that took a while to get done. The clue that was brought in.
Okay. Now you were your term was expiring. It looked like you were going to stay on for another year at some point.
Right.
Why was that? Was that unusual? Or?
Well, I think the oddity. What tells you a lot about what happens in the municipal industry is. When you're on the MSRB, you have a spot. So your spot might be a bank spot, a broker-dealer spot, or whatever, right? And I think what was going on is there were a number of firms, because of the financial crisis, they were leaving the industry and all. And some of the board members actually were no longer affiliated with the organizations they started when they were on the board. So what was happening is, and there were these partial terms being left over. The normal term is 3 years, and you're off the board. But because of that, there were these odd periods, and they were like someone, I forgot who it was they were on for a 3-year term, but because their firm changed and they left their firm, they could no longer serve their 3rd year. So I was originally filling in the 3rd year for somebody else who had left the board, or was about to leave the board. But then what happened that summer, both Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, and Goldman Sachs became a bank, so that two of our board members who were broker-dealer affiliates changed their roles. They both went to banks. So the two broker-dealer spots were now held by banks, since you can only have 5 banks. So actually, it got very... There were a lot. It shows you what was going on in the industry. The whole market was changing. Firms were changing. They were being reclassified from broker-dealers to banks. But because of the makeup of the organization, we had wound up having too many banks on. So I just came off because we had more banks than we needed.
Okay. Interesting.
It was just one of those things.
Yeah.
Because basically, at the end, it's changed obviously with the new rules, but it was color coded. 5 banks, 5 broker-dealers,
right,
5
right.
public.
Right.
So when 2 of the broker dealers became banks, we had 3 banks, 3 broker-dealers, and 7 banks, which is that's no good.
Yeah.
So I
hadn't thought of that.
No, that's what drove that. That's why, and it all happened that summer.
So you've got new rules then, or MSRB has new
Well,
rules?
Under the Dodd-Frank rules, they've rechanged the whole regulatory regime. The board now it has a majority public member,
right. Okay.
And they've increased the board size, but in part because of those terms. They're trying to have an orderly transition.
Okay. The other thing is, you could have been chairman for another term. Is that correct?
Possible.
Yeah. Was that ever an option?
I thought about it. I considered, but also at some point in your life, it's a lot of work. I will tell you, it's a lot of work. I mean, it's a challenge. You have your regular job plus doing that. So it was very time consuming. So it was exhausting. Look, I think my final year, in some ways, I'm glad I didn't stay on because it was just you spend so much time doing it, then it's kind of like you need to get a little bit away to somebody else's turn. So.
Yeah. And you probably. Verge on losing track of what's happening in this building.
Something like that.
Yeah.
You do have a couple of jobs. You got another job you have to deal with too. So,
yeah.
And same thing because of what was going on in the market. If you can't, you had to be so focused on your own, your own firm. So,
okay. Anything that we haven't discussed that we should touch on?
I think if you go back, the municipal market obviously has been very important, I think, to government. In terms of the amount of capital it raised, what it does, and I think the MSRB is trying to be much more active in preserving the integrity of that market. I think it's doing a good job. I think the challenge for it going forward is that, the makeup is very different. So I think just the whole internal governance thing is going to be challenging for them with the new board. Finding a majority of members who have some understanding in this market is going to be hard, right? I mean, it doesn't have the same notoriety or attention that the corporate model or equity markets have.
The public members,
right? Okay. So I think that's going to be a real challenge for them. But I think it's just they're going to have to they will, and I think they're doing it now, investing a lot more time and effort identifying candidates, because I think that's really going to be the challenge for them. Because You know, in the past, when you only have a third of your members being public members, it's a lot easier. When you've got a majority, it clearly changes the whole process of finding members. But I think, you know, look, I think you know, Lynette's done a fine job. I think the staff's done a fine job. I think, you know, clearly this year is a transition year with the first year when they go primary, you know, majority public. But I think the history has shown that the MSRB has done a good job of adjusting to changing times.
Yeah, certainly in the last few years.
Yes, it has.
All right. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.